One day in 1968, Iowa school teacher Jane Elliott divided her third grade class into blue-eyed and brown-eyed groups and gave them a lesson in discrimination. It's a lesson we're still learning from over 40 years later. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week continues today with a look at two well-known Iowa experiments. We'll talk with Jane Elliott and one of her students about that 1968 classroom exercise in discrimination and its repercussions nationwide. Before that, we'll talk about the so-called Monster Study from 1939. That's the name given to an infamous University of Iowa stuttering experiment. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week on our talk shows, and today, an hour, we've called Iowa Experiments. We'll talk about two of them in Iowa history that made news far beyond our state's borders. Later in the hour, the famous blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise. Perhaps you remember this. One day in 1968, Iowa school teacher Jane Elliott divided her third grade class in the little town of Riceville, Iowa, into blue-eyed and brown-eyed groups and then proceeded to give them a lesson in discrimination. It's a lesson we're still learning from over 40 years later. And we'll talk with Jane Elliott live in the second half hour of our program, along with one of her students from her class about that classroom exercise. But first, the so-called Monster Study from 1939. In 1939, Mary Tudor was 22 years old and a graduate student in psychology at the University of Iowa. In January of that year, her faculty advisor, Wendell Johnson, sent her to the Iowa Soldiers Orphans Home in Davenport to research something called evaluative labeling. This was in regards to stuttering. Now, Johnson's theory was that positive reinforcement could help stutterers overcome their problems and that stuttering develops when speakers are criticized for normal mistakes. In other words, part of the reason that Tudor went to the orphanage was to see if she could turn normal children into stutterers. Joining us now to explain more about this fascinating case and the lawsuit that followed, Tricia Zabrowski, professor of communication sciences and disorders at the University of Iowa. Tricia, welcome to us.
Welcome
to you.
Hi, Ben.
Having speech problems today of my own. Let's talk first of all about Wendell Johnson's intent here. What was he trying to prove when he sent Mary Tudor, this graduate student, to Davenport?
It's really interesting. I'm sure there's been lots of discussion about what he was trying to prove over the years. And if you actually go back and look at the document that Mary Tudor wrote, her master's thesis, there really is not much of an introductory section. There really aren't hypotheses that she set out. She really just merely describes what she wants to do and doesn't talk too much about what she thinks will happen. Mm-hmm. So I can only assume that he wanted to see what would happen if you give different labels to the same speech production. What will happen?
Okay, so describe exactly what she did with these orphans past what I did in that brief description.
So what she did was there were four groups of kids. There were two groups of kids who had been determined to be stuttering and two groups of kids who weren't. And so she went to the orphanage and she said different things to each of the four groups. So she talked with kids who had been diagnosed to be stuttering, and to one group she said, you're stuttering, don't do that, basically. Mm-hmm. To the other group she said, you're talking really well. You talk very well. You're a good talker. And then she did the same thing to the two groups of kids who didn't stutter. So
we're having four groups, actually.
Four groups, right. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to know what would happen. Would you see any change? And there were two things she wanted to know. She wanted to know, are there going to be changes in the frequency of disfluency among those four groups? And will there also be more qualitative changes? So will you see that these children will start to avoid talking? Do they seem uncomfortable? So she really was looking at some pretty specific things in terms of fluency, but also more general attitudinal sorts of changes that the kids may show.
And in fact, what did the study reveal?
Well, it was a couple of things. If you actually go back and look at the data, the kids – so the group of interest in recent years has been the group of kids who were not stuttering and were told that they were. That's the group of interest. And that's the one that the lawsuit was about. And if you actually look at the speech disfluency data, so there were a panel of judges, speech-language pathologists, who evaluated the speech of these kids before and after this so-called treatment. There is no evidence that these kids were producing more disfluency or stuttering-like behaviors as a result of the, quote, negative evaluation.
So let me get this straight. The non-stutterers, this is the group, the one of the four groups we're talking about, the non-stutterers were told things like what?
You are stuttering when you're talking. You must not do that. Try to do everything you can to not stutter. Things like that. So it wasn't that you're bad for doing it. It was that the behavior is something that's undesirable, and so try not to.
And the data revealed that there was actually no effect on these children.
Right.
Okay.
And in fact, if you interestingly, if you look at the number, so the speech pathologists rated these kids on a scale. It was a severity rating scale. And actually, a couple of the kids looked like their speech became more fluent as a result of this. But the rating scale was something like 1 to 5. So it's difficult to know exactly what that tells you. I think what's of interest, though, is that while their speech didn't seem to change, when you look at Mary Tudor's narrative about the experiment, she does talk about the fact that the kids seemed uncomfortable when she came to see them.
She made them feel self-conscious and insecure about their speech.
So they didn't like to spend time with her. That's my takeaway from that, is that it wasn't really a necessarily negative experience, but they didn't necessarily want to talk with her. The other thing that I think that's notable, Ben, is that one of the first things she says in her thesis is that the experiment, the protocol called for the matrons, is what they were called at the time, at the orphanage, the caretakers of these children, to actually be the ones delivering the, quote, treatment, that it was the caregivers who were to be telling kids these things. Not just Mary Tudor, because she couldn't be there all the time. And so the dosage was supposed to be kind of every day. These kids were getting...
And that was carried out over how long of a period?
You know, that's a good question. I used to know the answer to that, but I want to say that it was several weeks.
Okay.
What happened is the very first thing she says in the results section is that she couldn't get them to comply. She could not get the caregivers to comply.
Were they just...
They just didn't do it. Over the course of their day, they didn't do it, or they couldn't do it. Or it's not that they wouldn't do it.
Not that they had an ethical problem with it.
Yeah, they just didn't do it.
Okay. They had plenty of other things to
do. Yeah, exactly. Or they did it intermittently. But the point I'm trying to make is that the experiment, really, the protocol that was designed, was not completed. So most of the treatment, if you want to call it that the kids got was from Mary herself, and it wasn't the dosage that she, I think, initially had prescribed.
Nevertheless, Tricia Zabrowski, we had a lawsuit in 2003. Mm-hmm. It was filed, a lawsuit filed by six children and their heirs. Three of them were deceased.
Mm-hmm.
They said that due to the experiment, the experience prompted lifelong emotional distress.
Mm-hmm.
It was settled in 2007. Three women and the estates of the three deceased who were the subjects of the study shared a $925,000 payment from the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that ended the legal battle.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get this settlement if you say, according to the data, what was the basis of claiming this emotional distress? we had the data in the experiment showing no effect.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak to that, but I've always been a little surprised in all of my reading about the case, obviously, and talking about it, that there's so little mention of the results of the study, the actual results, the influence on the speech of these kids. So the discussion is all about the emotional toll that it took.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my thinking as a scientist is, I don't know how, I'm not saying that that couldn't happen, but I don't know how you could ever prove a functional relationship between emotional distress and what, in a global way, and what happened. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know how you can disentangle the experiences that they had in childhood, living in this home, being orphan children, and emotional distress.
Mm-hmm. I believe they claimed that they were always then after that reluctant to speak in public, and from that point on, they didn't communicate very well. They they used fewer words than they might have. That was the claim here too. Let's talk about this ethically as someone conducting a scientific experiment. We can see it through the lens of today's ethics, or we can go back to that day, 1939, and talk about the ethics then. So in the ethics of that day, this was seen as unproblematic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really wasn't. There was so much research going on at the time all over the country in the absence of good laws and policies for, you know, the protection of human subjects. So there was a lot of stuff going on back then. So
this seems pretty minor compared to a lot of the things, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, it was not unusual.
So how did it come to be called the monster study?
There's an individual named Franklin Silverman. I'm not quite sure that he's the person who first coined that term, but he actually was a student here at the University of Iowa, and he's a person who studied himself. And in 1988, he wrote an article for one of our professional journals, Journal of Fluency Disorders, where I publish a lot of my stuff, where he described the study. And he is the person, I think, who first coined that term, meaning, Wendell Johnson and his students created monsters.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Tricia Zabrowski, professor of communication sciences and disorders at the University of Iowa. She's helping us recall the so-called monster study from 1939. It was I guess the crux of the problem, the problematic part of this study, was going to an orphanage in Davenport. Mary Tudor, a graduate student under the advisor Wendell Johnson, went to the orphanage in part to see if she could turn normal children into stutterers. So the other ethical question that I raised, too, seen through today's ethics, science, as they have developed in the intervening decades, if this was proposed today, would it immediately raise a red flag?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, right before I came over here, I was just redoing an application that I submitted to our institutional review board. And because there are so many questions that come back that you have to really go to great lengths in your applications nowadays to Human Subjects Protection Agency to make sure that you're describing very clearly exactly what you're going to do and any potential risks, no matter how minor. So this, you could easily talk about the potential risks of this particular study, that the children may not like it, they may feel uncomfortable. It would not fly today. It would not pass.
Mm-hmm. What drove Wendell Johnson to work on stuttering? Wasn't it that he himself was a stutterer?
He was a person who stuttered himself, yes. And I do think that it's unfortunate to those of us in the field and I think the general population too, that the monster study, so-called monster study, is what comes to mind quickly when you think about Wendell Johnson, because actually his contributions to the treatment of stuttering far, I think, outweigh the significance.
Talk about that. This study's relevance for today and the intervening research that has been done. How does it tie in with all that body of knowledge?
Well, Wendell Johnson was a person who stuttered, and he spent most of his life studying his own stuttering and using that study as a way to develop behavioral interventions for helping people who stutter change the way they talk. He really was the first person to think about how we might change the behavior of stuttering therapeutically, and gave us lots of really important strategies that have stood the test of time.
For instance?
Something called stuttering modification. So my way of describing it to people with whom I work is that you catch the moment of stuttering on the fly. You grab it while you're doing it and you change it. So rather than stay stuck in a moment like that, while you're talking, you grab it and change it. So that's a behavioral intervention that came from Wendell Johnson's examination of his own talking, paying attention to what he did when he talked, and how might I change that moment? And that's a really powerful intervention strategy that's still used today.
Mm-hmm. And so we can tie that. I mean, in a way, this 1939 study was an intervention study as well.
He was interested in the listener's so in addition to speech production and how you can be aware of that as a person who stutters and change it yourself, he was really interested as well in the listening environment's response to stuttering and the dance. So someone who stutters talks, the listener reacts, and then what does the speaker do in response to that reaction? He was the first person actually to understand the importance between the speaker, the listener, and back to the speaker again.
So describe concisely how stuttering works, how that dynamic works between stutterer and listener, and mm-hmm. the listener reinforces the stuttering?
Well, so if I'm someone who stutters and I'm talking to you and I stutter something like that, and you're going to respond, usually nonverbally. Right?
You'll be, of course, as a stutterer, looking for cues in my face that this is not running well.
That you're alarmed or you don't know what's happening, or you may interrupt me. And that may
interrupt to help even. Yeah.
Interrupt to help. Exactly. And so I may somehow get the message that this thing that I'm doing is something I don't want to do or shouldn't do. And I may try to help myself. And the ways that I may try to help myself might not necessarily be adaptive. So I may substitute words. I may try not to by physically tensing muscles. I might my speech muscles. I might say something different. I might just stop talking. And Johnson was really interested in that dance. So that's why he wanted to understand how listener perception might influence the way stuttering plays out in the real world, not necessarily how it begins in young kids, but how it plays out and develops. Mm-hmm. Before Wendell Johnson, stuttering was considered to be a psychiatric problem, that it was only caused by something in the speaker. He was really the first person to open it up to this consideration that, yeah, it's something the person does, but the way the listening environment reacts is also something to take into consideration.
So what is the seed of stuttering? Mm. It must come from somewhere if this seed grows and gets reinforced by a listener. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know what? I would not have a job if I knew the answer to that question. You know, sort of what causes stuttering. Now the research, and this may be a good time to talk about that, the research now suggests that stuttering probably has some genetic predisposition, that stuttering itself is not inherited, but the predisposition to develop stuttering maybe is genetically transmitted. Whether or not a child will begin to stutter is the result of the complex interaction of lots of different environmental and constitutional factors. But stuttering probably develops. So once a child is stuttering, it probably develops through that same complex interaction, and listening environment and reaction is a part of that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a parent. I catch my I don't know what time in life this normally arises. When it does,
between 2 and 5 years of age.
Between 2 and 5 years
begins.
Old. So mm-hmm. Chances are a preschool teacher, mm-hmm. some teacher would catch mm-hmm. it. A parent mm-hmm. would catch mm-hmm. it. What then? You want to catch it as early as possible.
That's right. That's right. Because we do know, research also has shown us that early intervention is it works, and it's much more effective than waiting and seeing. So one of the things that we do is we talk with parents about how to respond.
Yeah.
So make stuttering a discussable topic. Don't act like it's a taboo subject, because do you understand how that then reinforces this is something that you're doing that's so bad that I won't even comment to you? That reinforces that feeling or belief in the child that, wow, I better not do this.
Oh, I see.
So make it discussable and do things to support your child's communication development. That's just a couple of things that we might suggest.
Today on the University of Iowa campus, there is the Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what sort of research and clinical work is going on today in his name.
A lot, and there has been a lot over the years. Clinically, we have the two programs that I think are the most well-known are our UI Speaks programs. We have two summer programs for children who stutter. One is for elementary school-age kids, and one is an intensive residential program for teenagers. So teenagers who stutter come from all over the country.
They come physically mm-hmm. to Iowa City.
And they come and live in Hillcrest Dorm for a week. And we have an intensive therapy program that goes on. It's a great, great program. I direct it every summer, and I love to do it. We also have a partnership with FRIENDS, which is the National Association for Children Who Stutter. And next weekend, October 5th, in Des Moines, we're having a one-day workshop co-hosted by the Heartland Area Education Agency, Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Center, and FRIENDS, and it's for kids who stutter, their families, and the speech pathologists who serve them. So that's something that we're doing. And I continue to do research in the onset and development of stuttering in young children, and I'm trying to get a grant funded looking at stuttering in adolescents and stages of change and how to know whether a teen who stutters is ready for treatment. So that's it in a nutshell.
We've got a little less than a minute. Mm-hmm. Tell us. So then with this in ending this discussion, how should we remember Wendell Johnson and that study from 1939?
I think it's most helpful to think about that in the context of Wendell Johnson's body of work. And to this day, Johnson's data and writings about the onset and development of stuttering remain most influential body of work that we have in that phenomenon. How does stuttering begin? And what are parents' perceptions? And this comes from actually data that he collected separate from the Mary Tudor study, has the largest database we have in early stuttering.
Okay. Thank you very much for a great explanation of that experiment from 1939 and bringing us forward to where we are in stuttering research, speech research. Tricia Zabrowski, thank you very much for coming into our Iowa City studio. Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Iowa. Tricia, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about the famous blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise from 1968. That's when an Iowa school teacher, Jane Elliott, divided her third grade class in the little town of Riceville, Iowa, into blue-eyed and brown-eyed groups. She gave them a lesson in discrimination, told the blue-eyed kids they're better than the brown-eyed kids. We'll find out about that when we come back. We'll actually talk with Jane Elliott over four decades after this exercise, along with one of her students. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Iowa Week here on our talk shows at Iowa Public Radio. For the rest of the hour, we want to discuss a famous classroom exercise. It was conducted by an Iowa school teacher decades ago, and actually a very daring exercise when you think about it, that's still talked about today far beyond Iowa's borders. One day in 1968, it was the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, Jane Elliott, a teacher in the small Iowa town of Riceville, divided her third grade class into blue-eyed and brown-eyed groups, and then proceeded to give them a lesson in discrimination, based not on their skin color, but on the color of their eyes. Joining us now live to talk about that exercise and the repercussions of it is Jane Elliott. Welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Also joining us, Jane, one of your students is on another line. Ray Hansen, are you there?
Oh, I am here as well. Thank you.
Sounds like that's a surprise to you, huh, Jane?
Well, yes. How are you, Raymond?
Hello, Miss Jane. I'm great.
Oh, fantastic.
Ray Hansen, one of the students in Jane Elliott's class. Was that in that first class that did it in 1968? Were you in that class, Ray?
I was in the 1969 class.
Okay. This was done years after that as well. Jane Elliott, we have a little bit of audio because there was a documentary made about it, a little bit of audio from the third year that you did this. Before we listen to that, I'd like to have you tell us, first of all, what prompted you to do this exercise? How did you get this idea?
Desperation prompted me. I knew that one of the ways they decided who went into the gas chamber during the Nazi regime was eye color. I had no other way to explain the horror of that killing to my third-grade students in all-white, all-Christian Riceville, Iowa. There was no way they could relate to what blacks were going through in this country at that time, or why a minister, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., an educated minister, would be demonstrating in the street and risking his life. What was he risking? I had to let them know how it feels to be on the receiving end for a day of the treatments that blacks in this country were receiving every day of their lives, and I had no other way to do it. I couldn't just talk about this. We had talked about discrimination and racism and what we've done to the Native Americans. We had done that previously in the year. But I knew they didn't understand what I was talking about. There was no way white children in all white, all Christian Riceville, Iowa could understand that. John Dewey said, we learn by doing. And I decided, and our lesson plan for the next day was to learn the Sioux Indian prayer that says, O Great Spirit, keep me from ever judging a man until I've walked a mile in his moccasins. Mm-hmm. I decided when I was watching that horror on television the night after he was killed, that not only were my students going to learn that prayer the next day, if I had to, if they didn't understand what we were talking about, I was going to arrange to have it answered for them. Mm. I was going to arrange for them to walk in the shoes of a child of color for a day in my classroom. I didn't know how the exercise would work. If I had known how it would work, I probably wouldn't have done it. If I had known what we were all going to learn, believe me.
You wouldn't have done it.
Ignorance is bliss. I didn't know how I looked to other people. I didn't know how white people looked to people of color. Until the blue-eyed people were on the bottom the first day of that first exercise.
Yep.
And my brown-eyed people immediately, the minute we started the exercise, my brown-eyed people started to treat me the way we treat people of color in this country. I did not want to know how I looked to other people.
Jane Elliott.
It was absolutely terrifying.
Jane Elliott, let's listen for a moment to some audio from an ABC documentary that was the third year that you did this, of you conducting this actual exercise in the classroom, you asked them at the beginning of this to set it up. You asked them if they wanted to do this exercise. They all want to do this, where the blue eyes for this first day would be on top the first day, and then here's where you explain the rules.
This is a fact. Blue-eyed people are better than brown-eyed people. Are you brown-eyed or blue-eyed?
Blue.
Why are you shaking your head? Are you sure that you're right? Why? What makes you so sure that you're right?
I don't know.
The blue-eyed people get 5 extra minutes of recess, while the brown-eyed people have to stay in. The brown-eyed people do not get to use the drinking fountain. You'll have to use the paper cups. You brown-eyed people are not to play with the blue-eyed people on the playground because you are not as good as blue-eyed people. Well, the brown-eyed people in this room today are going to wear collars so that we can tell from a distance what color your eyes are. On page 127. Is everyone ready? Everyone but Laurie. Ready, Laurie?
Brown-eyed.
She's a brown-eyed. You begin to notice today that we spend a great deal of time waiting for brown-eyed people. The yardstick's gone. Well, okay. I don't see the yardstick, do you?
It's coming over there. Hey, Mrs. Egg, you better keep that on your desk so if the brown-eyed people get out of hand.
Oh, you think if the brown-eyed people get out of hand, that would be the thing to use? Who goes first to lunch? The blue-eyed people. No brown-eyed people go back for seconds. Blue-eyed people may go back for seconds. Brown-eyed people do not.
Brown-eyed.
Don't you know?
They're not smart.
Is that the only reason?
It might take too much.
Okay, quietly.
Jane Elliott in audio from many decades ago, conducting her famous blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise and discrimination exercise that kids could take part in. Jane Elliott with us by phone. I want to include you, Ray Hansen. You're a student, former student of Jane Elliott's. Do you remember that moment when Jane Elliott, your teacher, told you what actually was going to happen? Because in this documentary, at least, we see faces drop. We see the children realize what it means, discrimination. Did you feel that as well?
That clip you played was from my class, and I was actually the person who made reference to keeping the ruler, the yardstick at hand so Jane could use it if the brown-eyed children got out of hand.
Wow. You were that kid, and you were wanting to please the teacher to get on board with this idea that the brown-eyed ones were not quite as good and might need some yardstick discipline.
Yeah.
He became a Nazi that day. He kept thinking up creative ways to abuse his peers. And that is not the Raymond that I ever knew before, and that is not the Raymond that I ever knew after the exercise. But he became what his teacher, the authority figure in the classroom, allowed him and encouraged him to be. He became the microcosm of the evil mind in this country. It was absolutely terrifying. I watched that pleasant, unassuming person whose mother I had known for years and whose sisters I had known for years become an absolute monster in the space of 15 minutes. I didn't like him very well at the end of that first day. Raymond, you became a monster, and you know you did, didn't you?
Yeah, I was reveling in it.
Yeah.
And so were many of the other students reveling, relishing the fact that they could take half the class and push them down.
And isn't that exactly what happens in society? 20%, the lunatic fringe in this country, does this on a daily basis to people who are different from themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear, and Ray, I would like to get your reflections, because the day afterwards, you were on the bottom. You were the one who was discriminated against. I want to ask you for your reflections. But first, back to the audio, because we have kids in your classroom, Ray. There might even be your voice in this little clip here, asking how it felt to be discriminated against based on their eye color. Let's listen.
Okay, you ready? What did you blue people who are wearing blue collars now find out today?
I know what they felt like yesterday.
I did too.
How did they feel yesterday?
Down.
Like a dog on a leash.
Yeah.
It feels like a chain them up wherever you go.
Into prison. Like you're chaining them up into prison.
Like you shut it up
and you're throwing the key away.
Should the color of some other person's eyes have anything to do with
no.
how you treat them?
No.
All right, then should the color of their skin?
No.
Should you judge people
no.
by the color
no.
of their skin?
No.
Ray Hansen, that was your class over 40 years ago. What are your reflections now on being on the downside of that equation?
My comment was it was like being thrown up in prison and they've thrown the key away.
Mm. And you didn't realize that until actually you were on the bottom, right? Because you were having, as you said, fun that first day, weren't you?
Imagine somebody gave you a magic potion that made everything perfect. And everything could go only your way. That's what the first day was like when we were on top. The next day is exactly the opposite. When nothing you can do is not just wrong, but horribly wrong, offensively wrong to everyone around you, or appearing to be everybody around you. And there's no way to defend yourself. There's no way to make a to protect yourself. You're just caught in a storm of negative energy, and there's no way to get out of it.
Jane Elliott, what about the way your students reacted when they did these reflections on the exercise told you about how they felt?
Well, what it told me, it told me something not only about how they felt, but about how people who are different from what we call the norm in this country must feel every day, and how they must feel when they go to school in the morning knowing they're going to be treated negatively on the basis of a physical characteristic over which they have absolutely no control, and they're going to be treated that way because of the ignorance of the people who believe in the myth of melanin. And for one day in my classroom, I taught my students the myth of melanin, which says if you have too much or only a little melanin in your eyes, your skin, and your hair, you're either better or worse than somebody else. And that's what we live with in this country. I think that what Raymond learned that day is how good it feels to be on top. And what he learned the next day is how awful it feels to be on the bottom. And I hope what they all took away from this whole year with me is the knowledge that this is what's happening, and we have the power as individuals to change this situation so that there isn't a top and a bottom based on physical characteristics over which you have no control.
Ray Hansen, did it stay with you after that? Can you think to a point in your life, an instance where exactly that exercise was brought to mind because of something you witnessed or experienced?
I can remember being at a social gathering, and someone began to tell an ethnic joke. And in the middle of the joke, I just got up and walked out of the room. I didn't have to respond to the person who was telling the joke. I didn't have to challenge them. But simply by leaving the room, I was able to communicate that this isn't funny. This isn't entertaining. This is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, it comes up all the time. A recent conversation involving the Trayvon Martin matter, someone said, well, gosh, why are all those people rioting? And my response to that was, well, if we start with the assumption that we're all the same, what is it that is different in the background of the people that are rioting than those that are not? What is it that causes them to respond so violently or differently to that outcome?
Jane Elliott, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I think what we know as a result of having been through the exercise is that we are able to empathize with those who are different from ourselves instead of sympathizing with them. And sympathy will get you nowhere. But if you can empathize with another person when they're in a situation like Trayvon Martin's parents are today, if you can say, I haven't been through that, but I've been something that has made me aware of what it is we do to one another, then Raymond, instead of walking away, and I'm old and I'm mean and I know it, and I have nothing to lose, socially or in any other way, when somebody starts a remark like that in my presence, I say, look, that's a racist remark, that's an ethnic remark, it's wrong, I disapprove of it totally and entirely, and I'm not going to walk away, I'm going to stand here. And if you continue to say it, you're going to see the look on my face, and you're going to see my body language that tells you that you're acting in an ignorant way and an unacceptable way. Now, obviously, I don't get invited to a lot of social gatherings because people are scared to death that they're going to say something racist, and I'm going to challenge them. They are, and I will. And Evan Burke said, the only thing necessary for the perpetuation of evil is for good people to do nothing. I refuse to do nothing from now on until the end of my days, which are, you know, they're upon me. I'm 80 years old. I am too old to put up with this nonsense. I am too old to tolerate it. Elie Wiesel said, you must not tolerate the intolerable. And when someone does something that is intolerable, based on a physical characteristic over which we have no control, I can't tolerate that. I don't have the right to tolerate that.
Nevertheless, Jane Elliott, in the intervening more than four decades, can't you point with some pride to the progress that's been made in getting rid of racial discrimination?
No. I can't point to it with pride, because it isn't anything I've done. I can point to it with, look how small a way we've come, but at least we have done this. Now let's build on what we have done so far and make a big difference in the future. Because the very fate of people in this country and of this country depends on our being willing to recognize, accept, and appreciate differences. Right now, we're in a sad situation. In that town of Riceville, they need the workforce. But people don't move out into the country and into small towns anymore. We're in trouble. We need workers. Where are we going to get them? We're going to have people of color in our communities. And in order to have a workforce, you're going to have to be willing to accept, appreciate, and enjoy the presence of those who are other than white and other than Christian. And we are fighting that tooth and nail. We are fighting that. We've got to stop fighting that if we want this country to continue to be a successful country.
Jane Elliott, we have just a few minutes left together with your former student, Ray Hansen. I bet a lot of listeners right now are asking, how did you come to this point of view? You're obviously a very strong personality. You described it yourself. What in your background made you feel so strongly about this prior to that exercise?
Oh, my dad said, if you wouldn't want it to happen to you, why would you do it to somebody else? My dad said, never put a stone in another man's path. And he was right. He said, don't judge a book by its cover. You don't know what that person's like on the inside until you're with that person. What's the matter with you? He was a Christian man, didn't attend church, but he was a Christian man, and he quoted from the Bible often. And he was right. He quoted the verse that says, and when an alien comes among you, you must treat him as well as you treat your own. He quoted from the Bible, and he said, and when you pray, do not pray on the street corners or in the synagogue as the Pharisees do, but you, when you pray, go into your closet and pray to your Father in secret, and he will answer you publicly. He said those things, and he believed those things, and he lived those things, and this was a Christian community, and I was quite certain that everybody else believed the way my dad did. Wasn't I a fool?
Ray Hansen, would you have wanted your children? Do you have children?
I've got two kids.
Would you have wanted your children to go through Mrs. Elliott's exercise?
Want is a strong word. The experience is one of emotional learning, like the death of a friend or a family member, or your first date or your first love. And you cannot unlearn that exercise. And what I want my children to be experienced to that, I hope it wouldn't be necessary. But if necessary, I would want them to be exposed to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any black people want their children to go through that exercise on a daily basis on because of the color of their skin?
Absolutely not.
See, this is the question I think we have to ask. Raymond, if you wouldn't want it for your daughters, why are we willing to accept it? For millions of children in this country go through that exercise every day. Do you think that gay and lesbian kids don't go through that exercise every day? Yeah, they do. And these kids with two fathers or two mothers go through that exercise every day based on a physical characteristic that they're of their parents. And my kids went on through it every day based on what their mother had done. It wasn't whether I wanted it for them. It isn't whether Native Americans want the kind of treatment that their children and their people get. It's what they have to put up with. I want no one to have to put up with this. And I think that's what you want, Raymond.
Absolutely.
Jane Elliott, we have about a minute left. What do you spend your days doing these days?
Well, today I'm spending my day arranging my husband's funeral.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I know. You didn't know that. But
no, I didn't. I'm sorry.
See, today, this is another day in which what we did 40-odd years ago is being seen in a positive way, because there's Raymond Hansen, and he's not going to forget what we did. And he learned something that day, and the word educate means to lead people out of ignorance. And that's what we did that day. And we have proof today And my husband supported this. My husband supported me wholeheartedly in this. And here's Raymond Hansen, and here's Iowa Public Radio talking about that. I could not be happier than I am at this moment for what the fact that what we did made a difference, and it is still making a difference. And Raymond Hansen is making a difference because of something that happened to him at the third grade level.
Jane Elliott, we could not be happier than to have you on our show today. Thank you very much for those kind words. And Ray Hansen, thank you for joining us. Jane Elliott, our condolences and our sorrow with you.
Hey, he's going to a better place, and Raymond Hansen is helping to make this earth a better place. And so is Iowa Public Radio by daring to have me on. This took courage on your part. Make no mistake about that.
Jane Elliott, thank you very much. Ray Hansen, thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank both of you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at Iowans at War, from the notable case of the Sullivan brothers in World War II to the lesser-known but significant involvement in the Civil War. Iowans have a long history of bravely fighting for their country. We'll talk about that tomorrow as we conclude Iowa Week. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.